It's Wednesday, April the 1st, day 11. One of the first things I read most mornings is Politico's London Playbook, produced by Jack Blanchard. It's an unmissable summary of political events in London the previous day. This morning, it opened with a headline, "What the hell happened?" This time last month, it continued, Boris Johnson had not chaired a single COBRA meeting on the coronavirus outbreak. Front pages of March the 1st newspapers led on Boris and Carrie's baby, the resignation of Philip Putnam, and leaked emails about the future of farming. On that day, only one Briton had died after contracting the coronavirus, 6,000 miles away on a Far East cruise liner. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, was on the Andrew Marr show that morning to warn that, quote, "We don't rule out," unquote, introducing tough measures in the future to restrict the spread of the virus, but adding, quote, "I want to minimise the social and economic disruption. At this stage, we still have the hope, although the numbers elsewhere are rising fast, that we might be able to avoid this outcome," unquote. Now fast forward a month. Most of the British population are self-isolated at home. Shops, offices, pubs, restaurants, leisure facilities are everywhere closed. Supermarkets are still rationing basic household items, and in some places, police drones patrol the streets and hillsides, hunting out people who breach strict freedom of movement laws. A Tory Chancellor, is spending tens of billions of pounds paying private sector wages and propping up companies that are in trouble. Hundreds of Britons are dying in isolated wards every week, with London's biggest conference centre transformed into a 4,000-bed field hospital. Johnson and Hancock have both contracted the virus themselves and can speak to colleagues only via video link, which the last time I looked, by the way, was powered by Zoom, a service of which other parts of the government are reportedly sniffy. And no one anywhere has a clear idea of when or how this is all going to end. Harold Wilson famously observed that a week is a long time in politics. Well, now a month is eternity. Who can imagine what the world will look like on May the 1st? And looming over all of this is the question of what it will look like when eventually this crisis is over. Of course, nobody knows. Hindsight is the only exact science. But I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about it. Couldn't get back to sleep, and so reached for an iPad and made some notes. Here are some of them. Attitudes towards death. Contemporary culture has specialised in trying to deny and avoid thinking about it. Well, that's over. Expect a wider and more pervasive awareness of mortality. And this will have profound cultural effects. Will it lead to a revival of religion or to other philosophical movements? The discovery that advanced societies could be pulverized by an organism 1 micron in diameter will certainly have some deep psychological and cultural implications. What about dating and mating? On the one hand, hooking up with strangers suddenly doesn't look like such a good idea. In that sense, it may be a bit like the impact of HIV. On the other hand, it will lead to new social institutions for, quote, assuring, unquote, safety. People have had the virus and survived it, and so have presumed immunity, though that may not be correct, may be at a premium. The economist Tyler Cowen wonders if survivors will wear the proof of immunity as a ring or a bracelet or even as a tattoo. In that sense, getting the disease may be seen as a good thing, provided you survived it, of course. And this isn't entirely theoretical either. Someone I know is currently self-isolating and living in a small house that he shares with 3 other people. There's a shared kitchen and bathroom, and to be honest, I worry about him. And then he reminded me that a few weeks ago he had a very heavy dose of flu, which knocked him out for a few days. Could that have actually been COVID-19? His boss had it too. And then I found myself hoping that it was indeed the coronavirus, because then he would have immunity, and I could stop worrying about him. Office work, and indeed the concept of the office, will be irrevocably changed, I think, which in turn will change commuting patterns. Millions of people will have been forced to get used to working from home. Many will find that it's easier than they thought, than they imagined. In many cases, they will find that they are more productive. Now, of course, if they have children who are not at school, then it'll be a struggle just now. But on the other hand, if before they had an hour-long commute to and from an office, they now have 2 extra hours in the day, and this might make them more productive, or their work-life balance may improve dramatically, and that will not be lost on them. And it'll work the other way too. Prior to the pandemic, many organisations and managers, I know from experience, were hostile to the idea of home working, perhaps because they assumed that people would skive. But when they see that that's not happening, they may be more receptive to changes. My guess is we'll see much more of people spending perhaps 2 days in a formal place of work and then 3 days working from home. A few months ago, a crazy tech unicorn called WeWork, which specialised in leasing office buildings and renting workspaces to hipsters. It had a slogan about how it planned to change the nature of the office. The guy who runs the video conferencing service Zoom now says that he aims to get rid of the office entirely. It'll be interesting to see how this pans out. We'll have to rethink supply chains. We have built a complex world on exceedingly fragile foundations. We did so out of a combination of arrogance, greed, short-termism, ideology, digital tech, and the worship of efficiency above all else. Well, the virus has now revealed how foolish that was. As Arnold Kling puts it, pre-crisis, our patterns of specialisation and trade were optimised for efficiency at the expense of fragility. Expect supply chains in the future to have a lot more redundancy and to be less driven by cost minimisation. The chief risk officer's approval will now be needed before the CEO will approve a major new supply contract. I think he's right. And in that sense, the crisis will remind us that redundancy is the best and perhaps the only way of increasing resilience and reducing fragility. The political economist Mark Blyth had a good way of putting this in the Open Source Radio podcast this week. It's no accident, he said, that evolution has equipped humans with 2 kidneys, 2 lungs, 2 ears, 2 eyes. The idea is that if one of them fails, then the system can still continue to function. What the coronavirus has revealed, in those terms, he said, is that we built an economic system that's the equivalent of running a body on 1/2 a kidney. When this is over, we sure can't go back to that.